Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Time for Microbrew Milwaukee Brewers Chatter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. My name is J.R. Radcliffe. On the other line is Kurt Hogue, Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We have got a week, really just a crazy game on Sunday at the end of it that we are going to spend a lot of time talking about. The Brewers go 3-3 on the road against the Pirates and the Yankees. In a vacuum, great. That's probably doable. They have a three-game lead still heading into the new week in the National League Central. They're up on the Cubs. That's a good place to be. Some interesting elements that got them there. Losing 2 of 3 in Pittsburgh, not ideal. Winning 2 of 3 in New York, great. But Sunday's game, the loss, is the one that is going to be one that I think people will talk about even long after this season. After my conversation, I got an interview with Wade Miley. I'm going to be completely honest with you guys. This audio is from weeks and weeks ago. I did the interview with him, and he went on the injured list right away, so kind of shelved it. Never really felt like I should bring it back, but one thing I talked about with Wade Miley is the time that he threw a no-hitter with the Cincinnati Reds, and that feels a little more timely now because the Milwaukee Brewers threw 10 and a third no-hit innings on Sunday in New York. They did not win the game in a 13-inning heartbreaker. Just an unbelievable game. So anyway, catching up on old interviews, making use of work that I did a long time ago and thought might not get to the light of day. Just a short interview with Wade at the end of this podcast after I'm done chatting with Kurt. Kurt, it's all about Sunday on this podcast. We'll have other things to discuss as well, including Brian Anderson, Josh Donaldson playing really well at AAA. We probably are going to see him sooner rather than later. But this game on Sunday, man, I don't even know what to make of it. 10 and a third, no hit innings. That is, of course, the longest in club history. They do not get credit for the no hitter. A one out double ties the game in the 11th. They then take a 2-run lead in the 12th that they lose. And then they lose in the 13th. Kurt, what are we going to do here?
I watched it live. I watched it unfold in front of mine own eyes like 5 hours ago, not even. And it still is so, like, it's still so funny to me that I cannot help but just tackle at the fact that that happened. I mean, it's the most 2023 Brewers game that you could possibly 100%. Think of, except for maybe them not having scored in the top of the 11th and finishing the game with a no-hitter and losing, I guess, would have been the only way to put the cherry on top. Like, they don't score in the top of the 11th there, and bunt and a sack fly wins it. That would have been peak 2023 Brewers. This was still pretty dang close. I don't, you know, I think, like, grand scheme, the big story is, oh, Corbin Burns. But there's also some other stories in there that are like, yeah, this is what the Brewers look like sometimes.
I couldn't agree with you more on the perfect archetypical nature of this game as it relates to the Milwaukee Brewers, because you had Corbin Burns, like you said, a starting pitcher, having a great outing. 8 no-hit innings, the second time he's done that in his career. Of course, the first time was 2 years ago today, if you're listening to this on Monday. 2 years ago today, he threw eight no-hit innings. Josh Hader threw a 1-2-3 ninth no-hitter in Cleveland, the second no-hitter in franchise history. They basically had a third one here. They threw he threw the 8 innings. Devin Williams, a hammer in the 9th once again, but that only sent it to extra innings, tied 0-0. Again, the offense, and we'll talk about the offense. They've been good in September on paper, but did not have it today. Granted, Gerrit Cole is a very good opposing pitcher, so he shut them down for a good chunk of that game as well. But again, great relief pitching, great starting pitching, amazing defense. In the bottom of the 10th, Sal Frelick goes up, makes an unbelievable catch, colliding into the wall. Joey Weimer's face gets in the way. He's got a bloody lip, but laughing about it because it's a play that saved the game, preserved the no-hitter. Abner Uribe happened to be on the mound at the moment. And then in the 11th, they just, you know, they do just enough to get a run across. Again, with the runner starting at second, that's not a lot. The Yankees tie the game, and then again they sort of scratch and claw. They get a couple runs in the 12th, and then they give that back because they surrender a home run. Andrew Chafin, who has struggled mightily since he's been traded to the Milwaukee Brewers, struggled again, and this time they lose it in the 14th because the offense just cannot generate more than that. We're going to talk about all of it. I do want to go with the good though. You mentioned Corbin Burnes. I mean, what's frustrating if you're Burnes, that's his third start in recent memory since August, where you've got the start in LA where he threw seven shutout innings. They lose 1-0. There's the game in Chicago where he surrendered one run through seven innings. He wasn't quite as sharp in that game, but he left with a 1-0 deficit. They lose 1-0. No offense there as well. Here, he literally goes 8 no-hit innings and doesn't allow a run, and they again lose this game. The Brewers are built on defense and pitching. That is the case, yes. If their offense can't do anything with that defense and pitching, you see what turns out. I mean, they were almost perfect today, and it didn't matter because they didn't have enough offense when it really mattered. Now, again, I said we'd focus on the good, so Corbin Burnes hasn't been great every start, I would say. In fact, earlier this week against Pittsburgh, he was, I would say, really struggled with two strikes. Wasn't as sharp, and Pittsburgh was able to beat him 4-2. You know, not blowing him off, blowing the doors off by any means, but it wasn't a sharp start. And he comes back, and he's obviously as good as it gets. What do you feel about Corbin Burnes? Do you feel like he's still a little bit inconsistent? Or do you feel like he's still throwing his cutter a little bit too much? Or, I mean, have you gotten to the point where it's like, he really is their ace. He really is the guy you're going to want in game one or any deciding game in this. Like, how do you feel about him at this moment?
Well, game one, it just doesn't really matter, I guess. Especially like a three-game series lines up. But I'm still Brandon Woodruff the ball in that scenario. I've kind of been that way for a while. But as long as Corbin Burnes' final start of the regular season is terrible, he's gonna be excellent. In his first playoff start, it legitimately JR has been on again, off again for, I think this is now six straight starts. He was terrible against the White Sox. He was bad against the White Sox, five runs, dominated the Dodgers next time out, got torched by the Twins, shut the Cubs down, got hit around by the Pirates. I actually thought he pitched pretty well in that game. Just had some really poorly located two strike pitches, but still four runs the Pirates is bad. And then basically throws the, you know, as part of his second no hitter in his career on Sunday. So it's that's a pattern. I don't think you can project it out and expect it to, you know, like, that's going to happen guaranteed that way in the future. But like extrapolating the good from those starts though, it's like, wow, it does not take much for him to turn it on with seeming ease every other time out. And that's 50% of his starts are just straight unhittable. Now, the Brewers are losing these games, which makes no sense to me. They've lost four of his last five, and three of those have been absolute gems, like you said. But the important thing here is, like, since the start of July, his ERA is 2.77. The walks seem to be down. The swing and miss is getting back. The weak contact is there. So, like, yeah, overall encouraging for sure. There's still enough, I think, frustrating starts there to maybe keep the optimism down a little bit. Like, at Pittsburgh, that just can't happen. You can't make those two-strike mistakes to that lineup. But, yeah, trending upwards for sure.
Ironically, the one start that the Brewers have won in recent memory is that one you mentioned where he got torched against the Twins. Brewers had his back in that game offensively, and they were able to get past Minnesota and get a win on that particular day. So that's odd. If I were him, I'd be so frustrated. I mean, I'm sure he understands it comes with the territory. He's a professional. He's not going to throw anybody under the bus, but it has to be.
I'd be frustrated, too, if I knew this was going to get used against me in arbitration.
Well, there's also that. Yeah, I mean, we keep flashing back to that, I think, as Brewers fans, and kind of the disbelief that we met that situation with, where, at least according to Burnes, he felt like the Brewers came at him suggesting that he was one of the reasons they didn't end up going to the playoffs. Obviously, that is hilarious on its face. I don't know if we want to go all back into that, but...
And arbitration might be some other team's... problem.
That's true. We don't know if he's going to go to another arbitration here in Milwaukee.
Yeah, we don't need to litigate that.
Unless
you want to. We're going to can of worms.
They are very lucky that they still have Corbin Burnes. Enjoy him while he lasts is maybe the message to Brewers fans on that one. I definitely...
I feel like that's that's a mean message to send to Brewers fans, like, but that's pretty much what's coming, I think, from this team. So yeah.
Yeah. I think his up and downness even extends to innings. I mean, maybe I'm wrong about that, but there, sometimes it feels like he throws innings where he is untouchable. And then he just loses it. You know, he'll be three great innings and the fourth inning is a mess. Now, I'm sure that's true of a lot of great pitchers. Like, you can't maintain that level of dominance every single inning of every single start. You know, we know that. So I don't know if that's unusual per se, but there are times where it just feels like he can't finish guys. He can't get those, tries to be too fine maybe, or whatever it is. He just stops being able to get guys out, get the swings he needs, and it ends up snowballing on him. But he is... Obviously, he has shown, as he showed on Sunday, he can be about as special as any pitcher in big league baseball. So that is encouraging. And then Sal Frelick with this defensive play, if they finish off the no hitter, that's, I mean, I have a list in my head of the greatest defensive plays in Brewers history. I'd be possibly willing to give a couple in the playoffs a little bit greater run, but I can't think of one that would truly rise to the top. The only one I think that people would truly think of is Robin Yount's diving catch to preserve Juan Nieves' no-hitter, the last out in April of 1987.
That was embellished, though, right? That was kind of an embellished catch.
I think the more I've watched that, yes, yes, it was.
I need the catch probability, Jay.
Yes, if we had catch probability, the more I watch that, I think you'll find the catch probability was pretty high. I also think it wasn't a bad idea to dive.
He had it tracked all the way, though.
Agreed. There's actually, and I've written about this, there was actually another catch, much more difficult, a diving catch early in that game. Jim Pechorek in left field making that catch, and it gets no run because it's the fourth inning. Why? No one's even thinking about a no-hitter at that point. But an incredible diving catch that ultimately saves this no-hitter, whereas Robin gets the glory. That's just how it goes. That's just how it goes.
What's your number one greatest catch in Brewers history?
Well,
or defensive play. Defensive play, it could be.
Okay, so two defensive plays come to mind. If we're ruling out Robin, which I think is probably number one, at least iconically, that's not a word, but that's the thing people are thinking of. Yeah. You've got Lorenzo Cain on opening day in the year 2019 for the final out, stealing a home run, saving the day. They win the game against St. Louis. Just the moment of opening day adds to that one. But anytime you can get a game-saving, you know, do-or-die catch, that's pretty great. And then the other one is Charlie Moore throwing out Reggie Jackson in game 5 of the ALCS against the California Angels, from right field, throws Jackson out trying to stretch and ends up being a huge, huge out in a game that the Brewers, of course, win to go to their one and only World Series. Now, Marshall Edwards has a great catch in that game as well. Ben Ogilvie makes a really great sliding catch in the left field corner in the last day of the 1982 season against Baltimore. The Brewers were winning by a narrow margin at the time. They end up opening it up the next inning, and they win that game going away, so maybe that moment loses a little bit of its luster, but those are the ones that I think are on my short list. Now, in terms of degree of difficulty, that's a very difficult thing to research. You know, there's a lot of plays that have happened that are lost, that don't exist on video anymore and things like that. Even early 2000s plays that I remember, you can't find all of them. So hard thing to really look up. But those are the ones that jump out to me.
I don't know if this is actually my answer, but this is my answer. It involves Yunieski Betancourt.
Oh, the behind Ricky the back. Weeks.
It involves maybe the two worst middle infielders defensively. The Brewers, certainly in my lifetime, I feel like the Brewers have had. Uni B for sure is the worst shortstop these eyes have ever laid themselves upon. And I think Ricky Weeks maybe gets a little bit more, like, worse flack for his defense than he should, but also it was bad. So the fact that those two combined to make the most insane double play I've ever seen the Brewers make. Congrats to them.
In terms of degree of unexpectedness, that's probably way up there. Actually, that is also on my list that you can find at jsonline.com of the great defensive moments in Brewers history. Again, admittedly, and it says this in the article, you can't account for a lot of it in terms of degree of difficulty. I even mentioned a couple that I remember very fondly but have no video of, so it's only existing in my mind's eye. I don't know for sure if those, if I gazed upon them again, if I would still feel the same, but I think so. I think they were pretty good. So that's at jsonline. I updated that after Sal's catch, which... Again, I mean, that's what these guys are here for. Like, we know the hitting, or at least the Brewers hope the hitting is going to come along for the younger players. there are a lot of guys that I would say are struggling. Joey Weimer, who did have a good hit, big hit on Sunday. Bryce Terang, Sal Frelick also has been slumping. Like, these guys still bring great gloves with them to the park every day. And Frelick flying into the wall, tremendous catch. It was his second great catch of the week, actually, out in the outfield. Joey Weimer getting in there as well. He's made some great defensive plays, taking one off the face, sacrificing his noggin for the good of the great play. And just an unbelievable moment. Just a scream at the TV moment. Now, this is happening right as the Packers season is beginning against the Chicago Bears. A great night for Packers fans, given that the Packers routed the Chicago Bears. But all of this is happening under the cover of that. They still have a no-hitter when the ball has been kicked off at Soldier Field. So obviously a lot of divided interest and just a crazy Sunday. I'm still kind of trying to wrap my mind around it as we record this, but that Sal Frelick catch, like, there are not many times where I've stood up and been like, oh my God, he caught it. That certainly was one. I thought the game was over off of Anthony Volpe's bat.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, the outfield defense is remarkably good. I think, there's an argument to be made if Blake Perkins is healthy or, like, Garrett Mitchell. So many options here. But I think already as is, like, it's probably the best defensive outfield in baseball. But if you had Blake Perkins, there's an argument to be made that it's the best defensive outfield in, like, I don't know, last couple years. It's
for sure.
Like, they have some serious studs out there that go out and get it. I mean, Frelick doesn't even grade out as well as Joey Weimer, and he makes these insane plays. Yeah, they got some good guys out there, and Christian Yelich might win the Gold Glove this year. I feel like that's going to happen, and we're not talking about it.
No, we're not.
It's not. He's fifth on the active roster right now. He's the fifth best outfielder, right? Or are there five outfielders?
Right. Well, Blake Perkins is.
Well, he might be. He might be better than Canna. I'm not sure, but
yeah.
Either way,
I don't know who I take.
That's going to be the guy that wins the Gold Glove.
Yeah, I think you're right, because left fielders in baseball are not very good.
Bad. They're bad. Yep,
primarily bad. Yelich is not bad. I would say he's fine this year. He's average. Certainly better than where he's been, and that might do it, given his offensive resurgence to some degree. Now, he has struggled and just obviously missed these last couple games with precautionary back, you know, resting his back, which is concerning, I would say, because you know, missing two in a row suggests that there really is something there, and given the way he's slumped a little bit, I think that we probably can assume it's been bothering him for a little bit. So that's definitely something that bears watching. But I, you know, Yelich is kind of like a lot of this team outside of maybe William Contreras. Like, I don't know if there's any one guy who's hitting so well that you just can't have him right now. I mean, their odds are pretty good that any of them are going to do just as well. That's maybe a fatalist way of looking at it. I want to speak about this offense in terms of this Yankees series. Now, they obviously had some amazing innings. They win both Friday and Saturday nights going away, scoring, you know, 8 runs, 9 runs. They absolutely keep, you know, just keep turning the carousel. Got hit guy after guy after guy getting hit. And then this Sunday game where the bats dry up. Now, again, Gerrit Cole pitched for most of that game. No shame not getting runs against Gerrit Cole. I would say there's a little bit of shame not getting runs against the Yankees bullpen, but I digress. I also think that is a little misleading, the way that they have scored runs in September. They have a very high BABIP. Again, that's a measure of how lucky they've been, and they've got the second highest mark behind Baltimore in September. This is a small sample of games, but it's like 356. It's really, really high, which suggests that they have just gotten breaks. The eye test backs that up. There's a lot of soft contact. There's a lot of good breaks. They drew a couple bases loaded walks in there. They've got, you know, Mark Canna getting hit by pitch with bases loaded. Like, I am not saying that they're not working hard. They are working hard. They're having long at-bats. They're making pitchers work, and they are doing what it takes when they don't have any boppers, when they don't have guys who are pounding the ball into the gaps. They're doing what it takes to score runs. You have to acknowledge that. I also don't think that what they've done in September, despite what you see on paper, indicates that they're actually a reformed offense, that they are hitting their stride or whatever, or like actually are a good offense. In fact, even the peripheral numbers will tell you there are, as good as things have been in September and late August, mediocre, even in that stretch, in terms of WRC plus and WOBA, these peripheral numbers to tell you what's kind of expected out of what they've done. It's not really there. So I would say I'm still bearish on this offense. I don't think that it's quite as good as it has been, But going back to what I just said, on paper, they are scoring runs. They are doing what it takes. And I mean, I don't know what more you can ask of an offense if they're not just doing what it takes to get runs across when they don't have people who are going to hit home runs all day. So just where are you at with this offense? Do you see anything in September or late August that tells you, okay, this offense actually can do enough in the playoffs? Or do you see what I see, which is still, this is going to be the worst team in the playoffs. And I just don't think this team can do enough to win playoff games against playoff pitchers. I don't know how I feel about that.
I'll start with this. They have, in September, to your point, they have been the third luckiest team, according to StatCast's expected weighted on base average WOBA, relative to what their actual WOBA is. Like they're 30 points higher than StatCast would expect based off of their quality of contact and angle of contact. I don't always super duper duper love that. The expected StatCast metrics, but I think they do generally over a large picture tell a tale. The Brewers do not hit the ball hard. Like these are not a team that has a lot of guys that punish the ball. You can see that in their damage numbers, their homer numbers, their doubles, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, I do think there's certainly some positives to come from this stretch, and it's not just like the last week and a half either that I'm talking about with this stretch. It's they've been scoring runs and wins for a month now, basically, since the start of August. When they win, they average like over seven runs per game since the start of August. It's hard for that to totally just be fabricated, but I do think a lot of it is like these bunch BABIP luck innings where everything falls, and there's just haven't been a lot of games, you know, where it's like home run in the second, three run homer in the fifth, two run double in the set. Like it seems to be consolidated maybe against, I don't know if it's against pitchers who don't have it that day, like they're taking advantage of bad pitching, which hey, credit to them for doing, but it hasn't been spread out or consistent enough for me to think like this is a sustainable thing. Now, granted, there's certainly enough good performances in there, and the quality of at-bats has improved to think that, like, yeah, three-game series, for sure. This team can turn it on for a few games. Five-game series, sure. But to win four series is still, like, it's the same thing we've talked about all year. Can they do it? I'm not entirely sure. I guess by the nature of September, anyone could do anything. Or not September, October. Anyone could do anything, but it's a lot harder to like fit into the anyone can do anything mantra when you don't do a lot of damage. Like they just don't hit a lot of home runs. Like it's kind of simple. Home runs do come in bunches, but it's the best way to score runs in October, and they don't do it.
Right, and I guess I'd be a concern seeing them against Justin Steele, not really have any answers there. Garrett Cole is the type of pitcher they'll see in the postseason. Obviously, not that they'd see him specifically, but that's the type of pitcher they're going to see. And they didn't do well against him. Now, at the same time, they beat Zach Wheeler and Aaron Nola, who are two actual pitchers that they could see in the postseason, and won both of those games. Wheeler pitched very well, but they won both those games. So, I don't know. I am constantly on the lookout for signs that this team can actually win in the postseason. And I just don't believe it. I know that it's all random. It is all random. To some degree, it is random. But the quality of team, the quality of player that they're going to be seeing, I just don't think they have enough offense.
The thing I think they do best, and if you're looking for a positive sign that's like most conducive to getting hot offensively in the playoffs, is like up and down the lineup. They construct their best lineup right now. Which I'm not sure includes Rowdy Tellez, actually. So I'm not sure who you put at DH. Maybe it's the Caratini lineup. But that's still a question mark, though. Like Josh Donaldson, maybe. Anyway, I think the positive is, like, the biggest positive is up and down the lineup, they can put together tough, solid, like, make you work for it at bats. They'll give some away every now and again. But, like, Mark Canha, for sure, it just adds to that. Carlos Santana, quite like his numbers aren't great, but generally he's putting together seeing pitches, like not chasing, like just guys that make pitchers work for it. And when you do that enough, like so many of Andrew Monasterio's good at bats are just a product of like making the pitcher beat him. And, sure. And by the end of it, the pitcher can't. And so that's kind of how they've worked their way into five run innings. enough guys put together, grinding at bats, and it grinds on the pitcher. So a 5-run inning in a playoff game is going to win you a game with their starting pitching. I just don't think it's like, I still wouldn't trust it consistently enough.
Yeah, Andrew Monasterio had an 11-pitch sack fly that got the Brewers a third run in extra innings on Sunday. That was a great example of what you're talking about. Of course, then I keep calling him Mike Stanton. I, for some reason, cannot quit, even though he's been Giancarlo Stanton for years. I still revert back to that for some reason. Giancarlo Stanton erased the 2-run advantage that the Brewers had with one swing of the bat. That's another issue, but... Yeah, so you spoke his name, Josh Donaldson, and we obviously talked about him a little bit last week, but I think we need to talk about him more because I get the feeling we're going to see him very soon. He had a really good run in Nashville, if it's in fact over in Nashville. He did not play on Sunday, and he had home runs in back-to-back games before that, Friday and Saturday, made a leaping play at third base, hit the ball well over a tiny sample at Nashville, and I have to think he's going to be in Milwaukee this week. They've got the Marlins. Speaking of teams that they could see in the playoffs, the Miami Marlins are right there. They're a half game out of that third and final wild card spot, which means that's the team right now that the Brewers would face, that third and final wild card spot. Mm-hmm. Right now it's Arizona Diamondbacks, but it could easily be Miami by the end of the day on Monday. So this is a time that they probably want to, do if there's still an opportunity to upgrade, to take it. There's this whole separate thing with Brian Anderson, who's been on this roster and not played since August 22nd, which is extremely weird. And it seems like a logical fit here that Josh Donaldson would take Brian Anderson's place on the roster and probably get some starts. I don't know if that's going to happen yet. We don't have that. We don't know that. It just feels like that. Why would he suddenly? He's had days off, but I think he had a day off just this weekend in Nashville or a couple days ago. I'm not sure when. I don't know if they'd give him another one, even as somebody who's coming off of an injury, if they're trying to ramp him up in time for some September at-bats in the big leagues. So it feels like that's what's happening, but I don't know for sure. Does it feel like to you that that could be a potential, not answer, but source of part of the answer to have Josh Donaldson here, and do you think that's going to happen soon?
I think Donaldson's here today, Monday.
You think?
My prediction.
Okay.
Like, you signed him. Seems fine at AAA. Like, I don't know what you more need to see. Your offense is not good. Brian Anderson never plays and he's on the roster. Weird situation. And like, why not? Like, what, it makes no sense if you're going to keep him at AAA for an extended period of time. Like, sure, his numbers this year weren't good, but this is not a Jesse Winker situation. This guy has legit pop still. And had the worst BABIP in MLB history situation. Call him up. The thing I'm curious about is, like, I think you got to play Andre Monasterio regularly still, right?
Well, where are the at-bats coming from then? Are you just putting him at DH?
Does that mean Terang loses some playing time? Does that mean Donaldson's off the bench? Does that mean Donaldson just plays against lefties? I think for sure it gives you an option to, like, play Monasterio at second against lefties. I'd be curious to see how reluctant they are to not play Bryce Terang, whose offense has not been good, but the defense has been good. I'd be curious to see what the ultimate trickle-down effect is on the lineup.
I would be curious to know how they view a lineup with Monasterio at second and Donaldson at third. How, if that is the same as having Terang at second and Monasterio at third, because Monasterio doesn't have a great arm. We've seen it kind of like...
It's not the same. Just that's because Monasterio is not as good as Terang at second. But I do think second
close,
base is Monasterio's.
But...
No, I think that second base is his best position, though. Like,
right.
His hands are pretty good. His range isn't there. I think his arm's probably better than Terang's, if I'm honest with you. He doesn't have the Brian Anderson bazooka at third, but Bryce Terang's arm is not all that good. I think we haven't really talked about that much because, like, it's functional and it's quick and it's accurate and it can work from so many different angles, but, like, this pure strength of it, not great. I think you got to try to get offense in this lineup. And if you think Donaldson can play third, which he probably can, and Monasterio can play second, I would roll with it.
I think you're probably right. Terang's offense has gotten to kind of a crisis point. I know I praised his at-bats last week, and you kind of pointed some of the numbers, and maybe more exploration on my part showed that that was probably the case. I do think he does have decent at-bats still. I think he's one of those guys who works for pretty good at-bats, but he doesn't drive the ball. He finally hit an extra base hit for the first time in like 25 games this weekend. But at some point you have to say, look, we just need more juice. We need more offense. You've got Bryce Turang for late game situations. He's obviously a great defensive player. He is going to help you win games with his glove, but I could see them going with this alternative layout, having Donaldson in there at third base and kind of getting better over there and maybe seeing if they can get by with Monasterio at second base. You know, the second they do that, it's going to burn them in some way, shape or form. That's just how this stuff works. But I still think that's probably one thing that they can try. As for Brian Anderson, man, what you wrote about him a little bit this week. I know you talked to him early in the week in Pittsburgh. He's not thrilled with the situation, but obviously he's saying some of the right things and just trying to, you know, he's a professional. He's been around a while, but this is a manager and a team who have always, you know, pushed the limits of what's on their roster. Everybody gets used. They don't have guys on the roster who aren't contributing in some way. But Brian Anderson hasn't played since August 22nd. I haven't gone back to look if that's ever really happened in the Craig Council era, but I'll bet you it hasn't. I can't imagine why they're not using him in some capacity. Now, you're not going to, he's not a world beater. He's having a rough year offensively. He is kind of what he is. Defensively, he's not, he does have a great arm. He's made some great plays. I don't think he's necessarily a can't-miss guy defensively. So, you know, like, it's not that I would expect him to play regularly, but I would expect him to get it. I mean, there have been some lopsided games that he hasn't played in. What is going on, Kurt? I feel like this is really unprecedented and weird, and I don't know if I have my finger on it.
Yeah, it's strange for sure. The Brewers, like you said, never, ever just waste roster spots, and they're completely wasting a roster spot right now for Brian Anderson. I think, like, keeping him around, you could see it like as doing the guy a positive. He's a big league vet, keeping him around the team, not just cutting him, putting him on waivers, whatever. But that would be like if you're playing him, giving him some at bats and, you know, 7-0 blowouts, et cetera, et cetera. They're not even doing that. They were up 7 runs on Tuesday's win in the 8th inning. Monasterio hit. Monasterio hit up 6 in the 9th on Friday too. So it's very clear that Craig Council's not going to use Brian Anderson. He's the insurance policy right now. If Owen Miller got hurt and Monasterio got hurt, sure, then he'd get third base. Actually, then Donaldson would be up. If Donaldson got hurt, then it would be Brian Anderson. Actually, Tyler Black exists too, so I'm not entirely sure. I'm not entirely sure that Brian Anderson's not the insurance policy.
You don't need that many insurance policies. You can make roster moves. You can figure it out so if it comes to that.
I mean, it seems quite clear what's going to happen whenever Donaldson comes up. For as far as I'm going to feel bad for a big league player for not playing, like, he didn't play great. And probably doesn't deserve the starting job right now. But, like, I do feel for him a little bit. He's in a weird position. He came back from injury, got a few at-bats, and then kind of got any playing time just completely stolen from him. I don't even think it's that big of a deal that the Brewers are wasting a roster spot on him. Like, their rosters have expanded now. There hasn't been a spot where you're like, oh yeah, they could use another guy. It's
right.
Just weird. It's just a strange thing.
If we're being honest, since he came back from injury, those at bats, they've been bad. They have not looked good.
They were bad. They were very bad.
Yeah, he struck out twice in each of the last two games that he's played in. He struck out a bunch of times in pretty limited at bats. So, you know, maybe they feel like he just can't do it right now at all. I still feel like, I don't know, can you not put him in at third base in a closing moment? Give Andrew Monasterio never, like, comes out of the game. Like, don't you want to rest him at some point?
If you're doing right by the guy, you'd get him in at a couple, I don't know, get him a couple of bats. But it's clearly not going to happen, and I don't think it's worth, like, getting cut too much. And
oh, no,
like,
oh, right.
This is killing the team. It's just a weird thing. And I, so, like, at a human level, if I was Brian Anderson going through this, assuming, like, nothing that we know, like, that we don't know anything big off the field has happened that hasn't been unearthed yet. So going with what knowledge we have, like, from a human level, it just feels kind of like, That's unfortunate.
A couple check-ins before we get to three up, three down on a couple players. I'm curious if you think anything has changed in the status of Garrett Mitchell and Aaron Ashby, if you think we will see those guys at some point. And we mentioned Andrew Chafin. It has not worked out for him. Again, another bad day on Sunday. I think he's still going to be here through the end of the year. I don't think they're just going to cut bait with him since they did trade Peter Strzelecki. They traded a big leaguer for him. I think it was a pretty low risk trade, but you know, again, the stretch of deadline acquisition relief pitchers, it's not going great. I don't think he'll be on the playoff roster, but again, I think I'll be here. I think he'll be here the rest of the year, I'd be wrong.
Playoff roster. He's still on the roster.
I think they need to give Ethan Small a look to see if he's a guy that can help them in the playoffs. If they want that second left-hander besides Hobie Milner, that would be my thought. I'm guessing they probably don't think that Ethan Small is that guy and they're not even going to bother. But, I think really nervous to put Andrew Chafin on the mound in any playoff game, no matter the leverage at this
point. So the issue with Chafin on the playoff roster, isn't so much that he's bad, but he's not even going to give you length. Like the ninth or 10th guy in your bullpen on a playoff roster. It's like Zach Davies was in 2018 when Gio Gonzalez, I think, got hurt and Davies got put back on. Like, I think he might have pitched in one game, just like ate a couple innings. Chafin's not even going to eat a couple innings. He's not going to get you eight outs in a, you know, in an 8-1 ball game. So you're certainly not going to trust him in high leverage, like unless he throws 10 scoreless innings the rest of the year, maybe. I just don't know if you even want to give six team in that many innings. Aaron Ashby makes sense as like the Chafin replacement, but not entirely like jubilant jumping up and down about his outing so far in the minor league.
They have not been good. Something's
missing from that still. I still think Robert Gasser, like, to try it, since in my mind the Chafin experiment's done. Like, you've seen what you're going to see. This guy's giving up way too many gopher balls. He's missing some bats, sure, but the location's not there. The heater's not doing what it needs to do. Just tons and tons of home runs to righties. You can't do it. You can't roll that guy in the playoff series. I would consider even more so trying Robert Gasser out now. I don't know if that makes a lot of sense still with 3 weeks left in the year, but maybe I would have tried it like 2 weeks ago.
I think that's
going to happen. I think Ethan Small makes some sense. Not a super enticing. Like, I can't really get very excited about that right now, just because of what we've seen from him. But I do think it makes sense from a standpoint of, like, he can give you length. He's a lefty. If things turn out really well, maybe we could sneak him on a playoff roster somehow. And honestly, I think you kind of want to make a decision on Ethan Small before this winter. Doesn't seem like the prospects of him, you know, sticking on a 40-man for 5 months are great, given what he's done at the big league level, and they seem to have moved on from him. But, that would be interesting. It's been rough for me, Chafin.
Left-handed relievers in general this year, not even just Chafin or Ethan Small for that matter, but like Bennett Souza, Thomas Pinone, Clayton Andrews, who got lit up again in Pittsburgh and ended up getting DFA'd. Not DFA'd, but option. My bad. He's still there. Alex Claudio, who's here for a hot second. I mean, if you want to throw Eric Lauer in there too, even though he's more of a starter, they just haven't been able to produce anybody outside of Hobie Milner. And you maybe don't need one, obviously, with the three batter minimum. Left-handed, you know, having that handedness isn't necessarily what it once was. They have developed some really exciting right-handed options, including, you know, Trevor McGill, who's getting high leverage situations and coming through. Abner Uribe has been really, really good. You know, I'm surprised you haven't seen more blow-up outings from him, because he can lose his control and his command, and he certainly has done that a couple times, but for the most part, he's held it together in some very high leverage spots, including on Sunday. So it's not like they need another lefty. They've just had some really bad luck.
Justin Wilson too. Remember that?
Oh gosh, yes, the worst luck of all with Justin Wilson.
There's so many lefties, and none of them have panned out. R.I.P. Thomas Pinone.
Truly crazy. And I guess, speaking of left-handed people, just going back to Garrett Mitchell, what do you think? Is there any change in your mind whether or not we'll see him this year?
Oh yeah, we've been talking about that. I think we do see Garrett Mitchell. Yeah.
Okay, interesting.
I'm not entirely sure how many slots in, but I think there's a spot for him to slot in for sure.
Okay, interesting. Okay, let's move into some of the more granular details from the week. It is three up, three down. Let's see, where do I start, Kurt? How about Willy Adames meeting his hero, Derek Jeter, over the weekend in New York? That was on Saturday. It was Legends Day or whatever they call it in New York, where they brought back a bunch of old Yankees. Derek Jeter, of course, was among them. And Willy Adames, some great video of him meeting Jeter, shaking his hand, talking to him, and then coming off the field with this elated, like, little kid just met his hero look, expression on his face. Really, really fun. And then, of course, Willy Adames hits a Little League home run early in that game, where he tripled in a run and then scored on an overthrow. So a fun day for him. You know, Derek Jeter is famously known, I guess, at least in social media circles, as a guy whose defense was overrated and defense maybe wasn't that good. And then Willie had a very tough day defensively. So the jokes were formulating, and somehow Derek Jeter rubbed off on Willy Adames, who, of course, is a very good defensive player normally. But the Brewers won that game, and it was a fun moment, really cool. And it is, again, a reminder that it's a reminder of Willy Adames' personality, first of all, how fun-loving he is, and how great it is when he can sort of be seen by Brewers fans for that personality. And also a reminder that, you know, these players, they grew up and worship these guys too, and it's pretty cool to see them meet their heroes.
Yeah, I feel like I'm the only millennial that didn't like Derek Jeter. Like, growing up as a kid, I was like, I don't like this guy.
I didn't love him. I don't know. I mean, I respect it. It was hard, impossible not to respect him. And he was very good. You know, he's a Hall of Famer for very good reasons. It's just, I don't know. Like any New York Yankee, I don't know if I could ever warm up to any particular New York Yankee.
Yeah, I don't even think it was that. I'm not sure. I'm not entirely sure what it was. Maybe it was like, I might have been being a baseball hipster and like, you all like Derek Jeter. He can't be that good. And then I got older and I was like, oh, wow, he actually wasn't like that. He's great, Hall of Famer, but he's not that good. He's the best shortstop ever. Let's chill, guys. But yeah, that was a cool moment. I don't think I would have reacted like that if I had met Derek Jeter. Maybe if I had met Scott Pacedna.
Oh, yes, probably. He is your boy. I'm trying.
That would have. Derek Jeter, nah. Scott Pacedna, yeah. That's the Drake meme.
Yes, I feel like. Trying to remember,
being a millennial reference.
Trying to remember when Derek Jeter debuted in 1995. I thought the other big shortstop that was starting was Nomar Garciaparra. That would make sense that, you know, the Yankees and Red Sox both have a stud shortstop starting in the league at the same time. But Garciaparra started a year later and actually didn't really, you know, he was still a rookie in 97 when he won the Rookie of the Year. So I feel like there was another shortstop with Jeter that came in about the same time that was really celebrated.
Alex Rodriguez?
No, I don't think so.
Who was the best shortstop on those Yankees teams? Even
Rodriguez had, you know, first like dipped his toe in the water the year before, and then was kind of, yeah, I guess maybe that's who it was. I mean, I feel like that's too obvious. I feel like Jimmy Rollins came a few years later, so I don't know, but whatever. What's your first for three up, three down?
Tyrone Taylor won the game on Saturday. The Brewers ended up putting like 9 more runs on the board, so it didn't look entirely like a winning home run. But bopped a go-ahead homer in the 8th inning. Friday and Saturday's games were very similar.
Yeah.
Willy Adames provided some runs early. That was the only scoring until the Brewers got to the Yankees bullpen. On Saturday, it was Tyrone Taylor hitting a homer, and then kind of like we talked about earlier, some BABIPing happening. Taylor's season continues to be sort of confusing. Incredibly slow start. Maybe not that confusing since then. More of a baseball season since then. Had that really, really hot extended stretch for like 3 weeks, then cooled off more than I even realized until I just looked up his numbers. Brewers could use him to get going again. Had a big hit Sunday. Didn't matter.
Yeah, he almost won the game Sunday. And that was the run. That was the hit. If they could have just gotten 2 more outs, Yoel Piamp, 2 more outs. They win 1-0. It's an 11-inning no-hitter, the first in Major League Baseball history. Tyrone Taylor's one of the heroes. But alas, it wasn't meant to be. He still hits lefties well and took a couple pretty good swings there and managed to loft a single on Sunday. And like you said, with the big home run on Saturday. For me, number two, C.B. Buckner ending the game against the Pirates on Wednesday. Ooh. Was that Wednesday or Thursday? Yes, days running together. It was a foot outside. It was a tremendously terrible call. C.B. Buckner kind of has a reputation for that. Not well known for his his judiciousness behind the plate, or consistency, I guess is a better way to say it, behind the plate. And he gave a really generous called third strike. William Contreras would have walked if it had been properly called. It would have been first and second with two outs. They still are down a run. You know, they probably lose, I guess, if you're playing the odds on that one. But it would have given them one more shot, certainly, to try and tie that game. They had that was a frustrating one. It feels like a given Brewers week. Like it's common like this. You know, they get three wins, and two of the three losses are like extremely frustrating losses.
Yeah, when the last non frustrating Brewers loss, I'm looking it up. They lost 7-1 to the Dodgers.
Oh God, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, that's probably the one. That's probably the one where like. It wasn't close at the end.
Yeah, Rowdy Tellez grounding into a double play in a huge spot there. It's been part of his really frustrating season overall, and they end up losing 5-4. They had a lead, gave it away, went behind, rallied back, end up losing by a run. Tough series in Pittsburgh. You'd like to think that this team could win 2 out of 3 against Pittsburgh. When you get a one-run game in there, it's kind of a coin flip, but especially when you had Burns, Woodruff, Peralta lined up for those three games. Losing 2 out of 3 there feels like a really tough beat. I think they stole it back a little bit by taking two games in New York with the two guys that you'd consider the 4 and the 5 in the rotation pitching in those games. But still, that was a frustrating series, and certainly the the called third strike was a big part of that one.
All right. So you mentioned him briefly. Clayton Andrews has been with the Brewers this year. Yes, that is the thing that has happened.
In Pittsburgh a couple times.
So his numbers in Pittsburgh, I'm just going to talk about them briefly. Opponents are hitting 778 with a 1.556 slug. That's a 2.356 OPS. He's got a 108 ERA in two outings in Pittsburgh. I don't even know what to say. That's not good.
That is obviously the tiniest of samples, but
it doesn't
look like he can be in the big leagues, unfortunately.
Those two outings could not have gone worse. Both big Brewers blowout wins at the time, and then one game Devin Williams actually had to pitch, and then the other one Devin Williams had to get warm. So it was rough.
Yeah, they sent him right back to AAA. Thiago Vieira getting his chance. Flame-throwing Brazilian who joins the fray.
That's right.
We have seen only a limited amount of him, but... That's another name. They have thrown a lot of spaghetti at the wall in terms of guys on the roster this year. So I don't know if he sticks, but they have had some success with some flamethrowers like McGill and Uribe. So maybe, who knows? Maybe this works out for them as well. I'm sure they would love a lefty. You know, that's why Andrews gets the nod over Vieira or a lot of guys. But still, you know, gotta go back to what's working. And it wasn't Clayton Andrews just yet. My third for 3 up and 3 down, former Brewer Andrew McCutchen had an interesting game on Monday. He burned his former team. Of course, McCutchen was with the Brewers last year. He hit a big double, a lot of 2-strike hits against Corbin Burns on Monday, and that was one of them, a double that helped the Pirates win that game 4-2. He then leaves the game, though, with a torn Achilles. McCutchen out for the rest of the year, and you know, who knows? Those are nasty injuries that usually last quite some time. I don't know if that means he's going to retire. Like, I only because he's at that point in his career, you could see that happening.
He ain't done.
No, I'm sure not. It's just a really tough injury to rehab back from. So hopefully we see more of him because you know, even though he did not work out for the Brewers, I do not think it was a good signing at the time. Certainly in retrospect, tremendous person and obviously somebody that's very easy to root for. You don't want to see his season end like that. He had a little bit of a resurgence at the beginning of the year, kind of came back to earth, and then unfortunately it ends the way it ended. So bummer for him. You wish him the best, and I'm sure you know, he's certainly, you're right, he will probably be back.
I'll cap it off with another thing we referenced briefly. Brandon Woodruff is the guy I wanted to give the ball to in game one. He had a dominant outing with 7 shutout, I believe, in Pittsburgh in the one game they won there on Tuesday. Struck out 6, just like not classic Brandon Woodruff in terms of like the raw swing and miss, but the overpowering fastball and like just kind of like being in command as a bulldog on the mound. Classic Brandon Woodruff outing. He is JR. According to Baseball Reference, 8th on the team in WAR this year.
Man, he's barely played. My lord,
he has appeared in 8 ball games.
Oh my gosh, that's.
I wonder what the high like. He's not going to appear in more than 12 games this year. I wonder what the highest someone's ever finished. Well, CeCe Sabathia, if he had only appeared in 12 games, probably still would have led the Brewers in WAR that year. But like, what's the highest anyone's ever been on his team in WAR? In less than a dozen
Yeah,
games.
I don't know. That's a really good
Uh,
point.
the actually, Jacob, where who is Jacob DeGrom? It's probably the answer here. But nevertheless, Brandon Woodruff is doing the shoving, as they say.
No one says that except us, Kurt. I
Sorry.
can't believe he's this good coming off of injury. You know, you had to assume that there'd be a little bit of a reacclimation or whatever. No, not so much. It's dominance. And like you said, if they go with Burns, they go with Woodruff game one, it doesn't really matter. Freddy Peralta has been pitching as well as anybody in the National League in the second half, and he is still a clear, in my mind, number three to those two. So that tells you what they got. And they're going to be in a three-game series. They're not obviously not going to catch the Dodgers or the Braves. Put that out of your mind. So they're going to be in a three-game winner-go-home series. They've got the studs on the mound who can pull that off for them. Do they have the bats? That I don't know. That's obviously what they're going to have to try to figure out. That'll do it for three up, three down. A couple things I guess we could have talked about. Actually, I don't have many things other than Sal Frelick making. I was going to talk about his catch in center field earlier in the week that was so impressive. That feels like a distant memory now that he had one that topped that on Sunday. So that was the only thing. How about the rainfall in New York on Saturday? Rain delayed both Saturday and Sunday's game. The Saturday game was significantly delayed. The outfield was flooded. You could literally swim out there. Surprised we didn't see any ducks or anything just moving into Yankee Stadium. You could not have convinced me that they were going to play baseball that day, and yet they did. 2.5 hours later, they found a way to clean it out, play baseball, played a full 9 innings. Good for the Brewers because they won that day. Wild stuff though. Wild seeing all that flooding in Yankee Stadium. All right, let's go back in time. It is Remember When. Kurt, they were playing at Yankee Stadium, as you know, so it got me thinking about other great series at Yankee Stadium in Milwaukee Brewers history, and there's just one that comes to mind, and it ended the way this one did, where they won the first two games and lost the third, and that would be the 1981 playoffs. Do you have any relationship to the 1981 playoffs? Do you know anything about that team, Kurt?
Yes. Robin Yount was a key contributor.
Thought you were going to say Robin Yount. And that was it. And yes, you're right, because Robin Yount is one of the best players, the best player in franchise history. So,
Robin
yes.
Yount, Paul Molitor, things of that nature.
Thanks. Thank you, Kurt. Great insight. So let me tell you about how it went. First of all, very weird year. Very much like years that we got accustomed to when the wild card was introduced, but because of the strike shortened season, there were two halves to this 1981 season, and baseball decided the first half winner would play the second half winner in the playoffs. There'd be basically an ALDS for the first time. They went back to more traditional format the following year. You'll know that because the 82 Brewers won the American League East and faced the Angels immediately in the ALCS. But this year, there's an ALDS. So the Yankees and the Brewers are battling to advance to the ALCS, and it's a five-game playoff. The Brewers lose both of the first two games at County Stadium. They are in dire straits going back to Yankee Stadium. The Yankees had won the first half of the season, so they played the whole second half, knowing that they were going to go to the playoffs. Very weird setup. And this was a situation where the season, you know, ended. There were half game differences. I believe one team went to the playoffs by a half game because by virtue of just playing an extra game when the season ended. So it was a very messy situation. But the Brewers go down 2-0. Game three, Randy Lurch is starting for the Milwaukee Brewers. Randy Lurch is not a name most people know in Milwaukee Brewers history. He was out there because Pete Vukovich was sick, could not pitch. And Lurch pitched them to a 5-3 victory. Ted Simmons had fouled off a hit and run and kind of ruined the hit and run, but then hit a big two-run homer instead later in that at bat in the seventh inning. That gave the Brewers the lead. Sal Bando followed with an RBI single, so they were up 3-1. He actually got picked off later in that at bat, but his teammates were so happy for him that they celebrated him in the dugout after he got picked off in a pretty big spot. So Rolly Fingers comes in, gives up two runs. Fingers, of course, is their big time closer, so it's tied. It was his second appearance in the series that he had given up runs. You know, we always talk about, well, Fingers had been healthy in 82, maybe they win the World Series, but he actually got hit around a little bit here in 81 when he did pitch in the playoffs with the Milwaukee Brewers. But then Molitor, you mentioned him, he led off the eighth inning with a home run. Simmons had an RBI double to score Yount. You mentioned him as well, sure enough. Funny enough, and the Brewers again, they won this game 5-3. A fan attacked umpire Mike Riley. This is in the Bronx at Yankee Stadium. The third base umpire had made a call that the fan didn't agree with, and he came out of the stands and he attacked the umpire. The guy got charged with harassment, trespassing, and illegal possession of a deadly weapon. It was a blackjack, which is like
a what?
Yeah, a blackjack, which is kind of like a weighted cloth, weighted like leather thing. It's hard to explain. But yeah, he didn't use it, but he had it on his person. So that would have been the thing everybody was talking about after this game. This is game three. Bruce did win that game, but
my goodness,
holy smokes. I think Greg Nettles like got over there and threw the fan down and you know, started the Yankees third baseman, Greg Nettles, kind of came to the rescue a little bit. So crazy moment that I feel like gets lost a little bit to history because this was such a weird series and a weird time. Pete Vukovic, by the way, was back in game four and he was able to pitch five innings, but he was still really sick. It was not his best work, although he held the Yankees in check. Brewers ended up winning that game 2-1. Fingers got the last out this time to preserve the save. Vuk only allowed one unearned run and two hits in five innings, so he obviously was doing, you know, got the results. Brewers got runs in the fourth on a Cooper sack fly. Ben Ogilvie had a two-out double. Jamie Easterly ended up second and third with nobody out in the sixth inning. He struck out Reggie Jackson, and he ends up giving up a run on a fielder's choice and then gets Nettles out. So a huge strikeout of Reggie Jackson in that moment from Jamie Easterly. This is the same day, by the way, that the Badgers shocked Ohio State, won for the first time since 1959. So the Brewers had to share the front page with Wisconsin football, winning 24-21. Fingers came in for McClure in the ninth and struck out Rick Cerrone. It was a big deal. There's, speaking of defensive plays, in the seventh inning, Larry Milburn for the Yankees had gone first to third on a Rick Cerrone single, but then Bando came up firing, ended up, so Milburn slides in safely, but Rick Cerrone is caught between first and second. This is a huge out in the game in the ninth inning, in the seventh inning. And they get Cerrone in a rundown, and eventually they wind up throwing the ball around the infield, and they get Jim Gantner throws to get the runner at third out, Milburn, who was then kind of trying to get home, and he couldn't make it back to third base. So that ended up saving the game for the Brewers. Rick Cerrone, by the way, was then the subject of a huge George Steinbrenner tirade after the game. Steinbrenner saying some very pointed things about letting Cerrone go and firing him and the whole thing. So that brought us to game five. Game five, winner take all in this ALDS. And it's a 5-3 Brewers loss. It's most remembered for a ball Don Money hit in the eighth inning. Honestly, you watch the replay, it totally looks like it's gone. It was not a good swing. He had to reach for it, but it totally looks like the ball is going to leave that park in the left field corner. Dave Winfield settles under it. It would have given the Brewers a 6-5 lead. Instead, it ends the eighth, and the Brewers are down 5-3. It really looked like it was gone. Goose Gossage was pitching. The Brewers did have a 2-0 lead in that game, but Reggie Jackson hit a big home run to tie it. Oscar Gamble, a go-ahead home run. Rick Cerrone had an RBI ground out. So the Brewers were playing catch-up at that point, midway through the game, and they just were not able to come all the way back. So they lose. I do think the 81 Brewers get short shrift a little bit because that is the first playoff team in Brewers history. The first time they go, it's because it's a weird format, so it kind of felt probably a little inauthentic at the time, just, you know, only having a partial season to hang your hat on. And then, you know, the 82 team obviously goes to the World Series and kind of makes you forget about the 81 team. But this was a really cool moment in Brewers history. You know, Bud Selig cried when they clinched the playoff spot. It was a really thrilling final, beating the Tigers on the second to last day of the season. Finger strikes out Lou Whitaker, and that sort of sets off the celebration. So 81 team is super interesting to me. I know I spent a lot of time on it, but kind of an unforgettable moment. With the Brewers and Yankees were pretty good rivals in the late 70s and early 80s, and this was definitely a good example of that. The Yankees ended up going on to the World Series. I think they beat Oakland in the ALCS. They lost in the World Series. So it was a fun time. Fun time to be a Brewers fan. Almost came back and won it. All right, that'll do it. Enough with the history. Let's close things down. It is Kurt's Take of the Week. Kurt Blanche.
Ryan Braun sends it for a center and deep.
Are we sure?
Is the take too spicy for us to handle? Is that what you're asking?
No. Are we sure? Is there any more 1981 content?
It was a lot of 81. I apologize. I got a little carried away. You know, Brewers, Yankee Robin Stadium. Yount, Robin Yount.
Paul Molitor, things of that nature. remains well remembered from the 1981 team. Also Don Money now, I guess. No, JR, no, I'm going to go with a bit of a hybrid here. I'm going to go between sports. I'm going to bend the lines a little bit. If people are listening to our podcast on a Packers Victory Monday, I greatly appreciate that. And, you know, maybe you've got another Packers podcast dialed up for once we're done with this. And
I have no idea what you're talking about.
We'll be done
about
in a few minutes. And then Wade Miley will go. So,
yes.
I'll get this out there. After Justin Fields' rookie season, I was in the same boat as him as 2019 Corbin Burns. And I sort of use Corbin Burns as a cross-sport, like, measuring stick So just kind of his career arc and like patience with a guy. I do this like mentally with guys in basketball, like, okay, give him some time. You know, he's, you see the raw talent underneath and like the flashy potential. And then Corbin Burns obviously had the worst 2019, like his worst season of like any Brewers pitcher ever.
Truly unspeakable.
But there's reason to believe like in 2020, you know, he could turn this around. There's certainly reason to believe he could turn it around. After Justin Fields' rookie year, JR, I was in a similar boat. I was skeptical. I was like, I sure haven't seen anything that leads me to believe he's good. But there's just enough flashes to lead me to believe that he could be good, and has a higher chance of being good than just like, you know, some random schmuck who might have had better numbers. But last year, JR, I saw enough. He's not good. And today, JR, I saw even more. Justin Fields is not good.
I mean, you realize your take doesn't quite hit home after this game. You know, it would have been especially saucy going into this game when people still had hope that Justin Fields was going to be the future for the Chicago Bears. And now,
I guess I'm not really on the record with many of my Bears takes.
It's true. It's true.
Publicly, at least. But like, does one? I don't know. I feel like one game doesn't change like the. I don't know. The Justin Fields believers aren't going to give up after this
you
game.
You can now. Like, you're invested.
There's still enough, like, I guess, enough flashy runs and a couple good. Like, he basically did what he did all of last year. Just didn't break a 50-yard runoff, and people were still believing he was good.
It's true.
Not good.
Sunday was a good day for Packers fans for more than one reason. You know, seeing the team play well with love. Seeing the Bears not be there yet, it's like, if you're the Bears, 9 straight times now the Bears have lost to the Green Bay. The record is 10 for in this rivalry, in the history of this rivalry, is 10 times the Packers have beaten the Bears. They're probably going to beat them a 10th time later this year.
You know, this probably feels a lot like what the Brewers-Cardinals matchup, I don't know, rivalry,
yeah,
I guess.
I hear, but yeah.
from 2011, starting that series until like, end of 2016, the Brewers had no chance against them. It was just a beat down every time. And yeah, that's kind of what this is.
To riff on the baseball just, part of this, step back and say.
So there's no hard and fast, like, you know, I've never written down this theory. There's no evidence to it, but like, after Corbin Burns was good again in 2020, it sort of reoriented my mind a little bit on like patience with talented players, even in sports that like football or basketball, where unlike baseball, like development's usually a little more linear. So I've tried to just hold out a little more on some guys, and like I think Justin Fields was like the exact example of it after his rookie season, maybe even a little bit into last year. Like, okay, this guy's got the 94. I guess Burns didn't have a 94 mile an hour cutter then, but like this guy's got the nasty slider. You know, no one else in the league has that slider. Keep throwing forcing fastballs down the middle, and they get pippity piped out to center field for home runs. And at some point, you know, you are what you show.
There's no way on God's green earth you could have told me in 2019 that Corbin Burns would take a no-hitter through 8 innings twice in his career with the Milwaukee Brewers after what he showed in 2019. I know that this has been covered. The terrain has been covered over and over again. The pitching lab and the Brewers' just ability to develop pitchers and, you know, develop that cutter and figure out what to do with him. But, oh my gosh, it was so bad in 2019. And here he is, the sustained, remarkable run that he's been on, success that he's had.
Athletes across sports just don't. Like, Vegas baseball is unique in that way, especially for pitchers. Like they can, you know, these guys can, if they have the raw potential, can figure it out. But yeah, it is truly unique for someone to go from being that bad to. I mean, he was the best pitcher in baseball for what, a year and a half, and is now probably still a top 10 pitcher. So
yeah, Josh Allen comes to mind from the NFL as a guy who was pretty much not it at all, and then turned himself into one of the best. You know, like that. Took quite a bit of re-engineering with him, more so even than I think Corbin Burns. But Yeah, you don't see it very often, and here he is. I really thought 2020 was maybe a fluke because it was such a small sample, and then 21 came and he won the Cy Young, and then, you know, 22, he had some moments where he backslid a little bit, and you thought, oh, maybe, but ultimately it ended up being a great season, and obviously cleared 200 innings and kind of answered all the critics, the nitpicking from the year before, and then here he is again, 2023, and it's consistent all the time, but it is really special stuff. So the Brewers... Brewers are/were lucky to have Corbin Burns when they did, and we will see if this is his last month, regular season month, as a member of the Brewers or not. But he's got some playoff starts ahead of him, at least one, and we will see how that goes. Brewers against the Marlins this week, 4 games against Miami. That is a potential playoff foe. This is a, you know, pretty big week. Washington then after that, you know, team that Brewers should beat. They lost 2 of 3 in Washington earlier this year, so you'd like to see them at least win that series and get the wins against the teams that are not at that playoff caliber. I think that's it, Kurt. Any last thoughts?
Nope. I got nothing for you.
Farewell, then.
1981 Brewers.
1981 Brewers. Love them. Love them. Great story. Short shrift. Okay, let's be done with this. We'll move into my conversation with Wade Miley. It's short. Again, it's from weeks ago. Forgive me. I don't think there are any dated references or anything, but, you know, it's fine. I talked about his no-hitter, speaking of no-hitters, since they're fresh in our brain after Sunday's game, and one of my favorite players on this team. He's fun, so I enjoy talking to him, even though it was didn't end up being very timely, but I wanted to share that now that I have a little bit of an opportunity. We will chat again next week. Thank you for joining us here on Microbrew. Talk to you again soon. Bye-bye. My guest is Wade Miley, pitcher for the Milwaukee Brewers. Back this year, he was, of course, with the team in 2018. And some of your best numbers have come in this building, have come with this team. When you were looking at where to go after this, you know, 2022 season, was there something just special about this place, special about this team? Was it, you know, what was it that kind of brought you back here?
I mean, I really enjoyed my time here in 2018, no doubt. Made a lot of good friends. One of my better friends in this game, Brandon Woodruff.
Yeah.
We've stayed in contact, you know, throughout all seasons and during seasons and stuff. But yeah, it's a good ball club. We've been playing against them. I've stayed in the division pretty much for the last, 7 years. I've been in, I think I was in Houston for one of them, but I like this ball club. I like the stadium, like the division, and love the coaching staff. Counts, Murph, Laner, a lot of people that I'm compatible with. Getting to know Hookie this year a lot more. It's just been a good time.
So here's a curveball question. The All-Star game's a few days away. Milwaukee Bucks had Drew Holiday, who was an All-Star 10 years after he had last been an All-Star. You were an All-Star 12 years ago. Did you think there was a chance the way the season was going early this year? Maybe you could have had that 10-year break as well?
No, I never thought about it. I spent too much time on the IL, and I try not to think too much about that stuff. I enjoy my home time and my 4 days off.
Sure. All right, I want to go back to 2018, end of the season. There's this game in the NLCS against the Dodgers, a little bit of subterfuge where you were listed as a starting pitcher. You come out for one batter and then you're replaced. Dodgers didn't love it, the attempt to kind of flip the lineup around. What do you remember about the discussions there? Was there something special about that game that you were going to kind of participate in a little bit of cloak and dagger stuff, or how do you remember that moment in time?
It was just I guess just trying to find an edge. They came to me about it and asked me if I'd be willing to do that and still be able to start game 6.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, sure. I mean, whatever we think is going to help us win, right? I don't know if I necessarily at the time agreed with it, just thinking more on the lines of old school baseball. Like, this is kind of weird to me, but it was a plan. We stuck with the plan. It didn't end up working out, but it is what it is.
And then game 6 obviously goes very well. Like, this had to be some of the best, I mean, some of the more memorable starts of your career, pitching that deep in the postseason, right?
Yeah, it was awesome. Yeah, I mean, I always look back, and I mean, honestly tried to come back here the next couple of years as a free agent. It didn't work out. They had a lot of young guys, young starters, and I mean, I understood that. I understand the process. But, I tell people all the time, between my 18 and 19 year seasons were NLCS Game 7 and World Series Game 7.
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
Pretty freaking cool, pretty special. But, yeah, it was definitely a good moment for me.
All right, I want to go back to a time when you were at Cincinnati. You threw a no-hitter against Cleveland. It was kind of a frenzy of no-hitters that year, 2021. The Brewers actually got one later that year against the same team. But what sticks out? I know there was a rain delay to start that game, which I imagine was, you know, I don't know if that threw anything off. Or, like, just go back to that moment for me and tell me what sticks out to you.
Just the way, I mean, that particular ball club in 21, we were so close. You know, we had just went through the 2020 season together. And I mean, you're together during that COVID year. I mean, it was everywhere we went, even at home, we were together all the time so much. And we just got really connected. I remember that rain delay. We were all in the clubhouse goofing off, you know, just playing cards, just having a good time, really relaxed. And then it just kind of happened. You know, it was one of those things where I think it was nothing through the eighth. So it was never a whole lot of pressure other than, like, let's keep it at zero. We were trying to win a baseball game, and then we scored three or four runs in the ninth, and that's when it's like, oh man, this can be a reality, and fortunate enough to be a part of something cool.
Yeah, I was going to ask about those 3 runs in the ninth. That had to change everything for you. At that point, you have no idea how it's going to end, but now it's like you're three outs away. I mean, you being a contact pitcher, I imagine that's not something you necessarily think about as possible for you, right?
I mean, I guess it's baseball. Anything's possible, sure. But in the moment, no, never. Even in the seventh, eighth inning, I knew what was going on.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know. You just kind of go with the flow. It's not necessarily like, oh, I want to throw a no-hitter. I want to throw. I mean, every time we take the ball, I'm trying to go out there and not give up hits.
Yeah,
so
of course.
If you want to be like, think of that thought process. But understanding the reality of it just seems like a little far-fetched. But, you know, it happened, and couldn't have been a better group to spend it with, and like this is still today some of my closest friends in baseball from that 21 team. So
right. Jesse Winker, who's here now, of course. Yeah. One of the cool stories, you got a temporary Hulk tattoo from your son and said you were gonna get a real one. Did that ever happen? Did you get a regular Hulk tattoo?
Nope.
The forearm
scared
is clean.
Scared of needles.
Scared of needles. So the change of rules before the season, the pace of play, you were one of the pitchers I thought of when that happened as somebody who already works really, really fast. Did that impact you differently? Did it take away maybe an advantage you have, or even increase an advantage because you're used to this sort of
if
thing?
If anything, it's probably hurt me a little bit more. Just, I don't know, just getting used. I've tried to like slow down actually a little bit and manipulate the clock. I find myself throwing pitches I don't want to throw because I don't have time to shake to the next pitch, but I mean, it really hasn't bothered me all that much. It's something like anything else in life, when changes happen, you just got to adapt to them, yeah.
All right, last question. I know you're a big hunter. Have you hunted in Wisconsin? Do you know anything about the scene in Wisconsin? Are there areas you like to hunt?
I haven't hunted enough here to know anything.
You're more of a hunt on south type of guy, right?
I mean, I hunt in the Midwest, but I haven't made it up this far.
Sure.
A little bit in 18 that year, me and Hader went out, and we did a little hunt right before the playoffs started.
Sure.
But it was, nothing like... Yeah, back home.
All right. Well, thank you very much, sir. I appreciate it.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's Essential Prenatal Multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.